All right, let's open our Bibles to Matthew chapter 5, the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew 5, we're going to read the first 12 verses as we start our study this morning, a new series of lessons here in the Bible class hour. We're going to be studying about Beatitudes, and when we think about Beatitudes, our minds, I guess, naturally go to the Sermon on the Mount and this passage. And so we're going to start there and kind of introduce the idea of the Beatitudes and look a little bit at what we're going to be studying about for this series of lessons. But Jesus says, or the Bible says in verse 1 of this chapter, that seeing the multitudes, he went up into a mountain, and when he was set, his disciples came unto him, and he opened his mouth and taught them, saying. And then in verse 3, you have the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount. And before we read through the Beatitudes there, just to remind us of the context here, Matthew, of course, is written to an audience that was largely the children of Israel. And so Matthew writes in a way that shows Jesus as the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy and the transition from the old law to the new. And that's ultimately what the Sermon on the Mount is. It's the beginning of that transition. So in Matthew's account of the gospel, he starts, of course, with the genealogy of Christ, going all the way back to Abraham through David to show that he is the true Messiah of the bloodline of the Messiah. Then, of course, he tells us about his birth. Then we have the preaching of John the Baptist, which leads to the baptism of Jesus, followed by his temptation in the wilderness. And chapter 4, following that, of course, the temptation, has Jesus beginning to go out in his public ministry. So he jumps to Jesus calling Peter and Andrew, James and John, to follow him and to be his disciples. And chapter 4 ends, verse 23, by telling us that Jesus went about all Galilee, teaching in their synagogues and preaching the gospel of the kingdom, and healing all manner of sickness and all manner of disease among the people. And his fame went throughout all Syria. And they brought unto him all sick people that were taken with divers diseases and torments, and those which were possessed with devils, and those which were lunatic, and those that had the palsy, and he healed them. And then the last verse says, there followed him great multitudes of people from Galilee, which of course is in the north, where there was a Jewish population in Galilee. Then you have Decapolis, which was the 10 cities around the Sea of Galilee, but it went into Gentile territory. Then from Jerusalem, which is the heart of the Jewish world, the capital and where the temple is and all of those things. And then from Judea, which is the southern part around the city of Jerusalem. And then from beyond Jordan, which is on the east side of the Jordan River. And so Matthew is showing us that people from all areas where the children of Israel dwelt were hearing and listening to and following Jesus. The region skipped over there, of course, is Samaria, which was in between Galilee and Judea. And Jesus hadn't gone there yet. But wherever he had been in Jewish territory, Galilee in the north, Judea in the south, and across the Jordan River, people were hearing him and were following him. So the Sermon on the Mount comes in that setting of all of these people are coming out to find out who Jesus is and what he's about, and is he really the Messiah? And this sermon that Matthew presents here in this order in his gospel account gives us the foundation of everything that's going to follow in Jesus' life and in his teaching, and ultimately in the rest of the New Testament. The Sermon on the Mount is the foundation of the gospel in the sense of the teaching of Jesus. Everything that follows through the rest of the New Testament is really just an expounding upon what Jesus taught in the Sermon on the Mount. It kind of takes the whole New Testament and, encapsulates it in this one sermon. And the Sermon on the Mount is founded on the Beatitudes. In reality, the rest of the Sermon on the Mount is an exposition of the Beatitudes. And so if we want to understand the New Testament, we have to understand the Sermon on the Mount. And if we want to understand the Sermon on the Mount, we have to understand the Beatitudes, because it's all built upon that. And to understand the Beatitudes, we have to understand what God means, what Jesus means when he uses the word blessed. And so that's going to be the focus of our study this morning and the foundation on which, you know, the rest of this series is built. So let's read the Beatitudes and then talk a little bit about what we're going to look at here. So Jesus says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are ye when men shall revile you and persecute you and shall say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceeding glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so persecuted they the prophets which were before you." And so the context of this sermon shows us, hopefully helps us to see the importance of not only what Jesus teaches in the sermon, but how it begins with the Beatitudes. And so as the Bible is written, as the New Testament is written, and as it's ordered and given to us in Scripture, this is the first preaching that we hear of Jesus, and he starts with the heart. A beatitude is, of course, an attitude. The word is basically the word attitude with B in front of it. But it has to do with a way of thinking in our hearts, which, of course, has to do with a certain perspective, a way of seeing the world and understanding what it is and what our role in it is. But it all starts in the heart. All of the actions that follow in the Sermon on the Mount, you know, whatever you want to talk about, loving your neighbor or how you pray or everything else that's written, it all comes back to what's in the heart. And that's where Jesus starts, and that's where the gospel starts. And so the attitudes mentioned here are beatitudes, attitudes that, you know, we should be. But it's really the idea of blessed attitudes. These are foundational to being a child of God, to being a Christian and living the Christian life. So notice two things that we're told here in verses 1 and 2. That first of all, Jesus, the Bible says, when he was set, his disciples came unto him. And the language here, you know, it's not just he was set and he opened his mouth and taught them, like, you know, if you're going to teach, you sit down and obviously you have to open your mouth. But these words are used to give a specific context and flavor to what was happening here. The fact that Jesus was set, that he was seated and everyone gathered around him, indicates his role as a rabbi. This is how a rabbi taught his students. He would be seated in a position of honor, and they would gather around him to sit at his feet, sometimes we say, to hear what he was teaching and to pay attention to what he was saying. So Jesus is seated here because he is a teacher with authority, and he's presenting himself that way to the world and to his disciples. He's not somebody who's just kind of an amateur at this, but he's the real deal, and he has the right to do this because of his position. And then when it says that he opened his mouth, that doesn't just mean that, you know, Jesus wasn't teaching telepathically, he had to use his voice, but it's indicating to us what 1 Peter 4:11 says, "If any man speak, let him speak as the oracles of God." When the Bible uses that phrase, especially about an inspired speaker, that he opened his mouth, it means he's going to speak the words of God. And so the language here is Matthew saying by inspiration that this was not just an ordinary teacher, but this was a teacher from God speaking the words of God. Just like the Old Testament prophets had done, there had been 400 years of silence, but now Jesus is here opening his mouth. He's going to speak God's will. And so the beginning of that is the Beatitudes. So, again, to understand the Sermon on the Mount, we have to understand the Beatitudes, and to understand the Beatitudes, we have to know what that word blessed means. And so, I know a lot of people say blessed, and that's, you know, the old English way of saying it. And it's just, I don't do that. We don't do it with any of the other words, you know, usually in the New Testament. So I just say blessed. But it doesn't matter, blessed or blessed, however you want to say it. But this word is vital to understand. And it's vital to understand because when we come to the Sermon on the Mount, sometimes, you know, when we talk about Beatitudes, this is where we go, where our minds go, to what Jesus says here. And we fail to recognize and to understand that these are not the first Beatitudes. There were many that came in the Old Testament, and they're not the last Beatitudes. There are a lot that follow in the Gospel. There are seven in the book of Revelation, number of perfection, right? So these Beatitudes are not the only ones. They're, in a sense, maybe kind of elevated in our minds because it's Jesus teaching them. But to understand the idea of a beatitude, we have to go back and look from the Old Testament how those were used and see how Jesus uses them and then how they follow through in the New Testament. And that's what this study is going to be about, those three sections of beatitudes, Old Testament, Jesus, and New Testament. And we'll see how all those play out and come together and give us a full picture of what it means to be a child of God and a true disciple of Christ. But that word beatitude, to understand blessed, we're going to talk about two things, two questions. We're going to ask, number one, what is blessed? What does it mean, this word? And then number two, who is blessed? And that will give us a foundation to study these beatitudes. So when we talk about beatitude, that word comes from the Latin. It's the Latin word for happy. But obviously the Bible wasn't written in Latin. It was translated from Hebrew and Greek into Latin. And that Latin version, you know, came down to eventually our English versions were translated, a lot of them from the Latin. And as time went on, you had more and more sources from Greek and Hebrew and so forth. But the Latin had a big influence on it. So beatitude comes from the Latin word for happy. And so sometimes when people talk about the Beatitudes or this word blessed, blessed are the poor in spirit, they render it as happy are the poor in spirit. And they look at the Beatitudes as Jesus teaching us how to be happy in this life. And happiness is a part of what the Beatitudes are about, but it's by no means the major focus of it. If you have the Beatitudes in your life and in your heart, you will be happy, but it's not worldly happiness based on circumstances or whatever. It's what the Bible calls joy. It's that deep down satisfaction and peace and all of those things that come from our fellowship with God and our salvation from sin. That kind of happiness. But it's not just you're going to go around with a smile on your face all the time. Because think about what he says here. Blessed are, you know, those who are persecuted. Most people who are being persecuted aren't happy while they're going through that. Now, we can be joyful and have, you know, the joy that understands what comes at the end of this, but we don't necessarily like going through it. So it's much more than happiness. The idea of being happy is not good enough to explain what blessed is and what the Beatitudes are about. So in the Old Testament, there were two main words that were translated as blessed. And the first is the idea of blessing someone. It means to bless or to ask for a blessing. And when you put that word, that Hebrew word, in its verb form, it means to bend the knees. So I'm going to read some passages from the Psalms that use this word to illustrate the idea here. And the first is Psalm 95 and verse number 6. And it says, "O come, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel before the Lord, our Maker." So the word that's translated as blessed is in a verb form here, and it means to kneel, the idea of bending the knees, of bowing down before. So this verse says, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel before the Lord, our Maker. And so it's saying, let us bless the Lord, our Maker. Now, How can we, men, human beings, bless God? That has to affect our understanding of what the word blessed means. We generally think of blessing or being blessed as God giving us something, and usually it's some kind of material thing, money or a new house or whatever we're wanting at the time. And that's generally how the world thinks about blessings. But if that's true, there's no way that we can bless God, because what can we give him? It all belongs to him anyway. And so blessing, being able to bless God, has to do with giving to God the things that he not only has asked for, but the things that he deserves. And so it has to do with honoring him with worship and with faithfulness and all of those things that God deserves from us. So while we're in Psalms, look at Psalm 104 and verse number 1. We have this word used again in this passage, and it has to do here with the nature of God, describing his nature. So the psalmist says, "Bless the Lord, O my soul. O Lord my God, thou art very great. Thou art clothed with honor and majesty." And he goes on to describe the great power and might and wisdom and all of that of God. But here you have the word bless. Bless the Lord. And so based on God's nature, man is to bless him, which again means to honor him as God for who he is. And so God is very great, he says. He's clothed with honor and with majesty. And so man, in the verb form, we bend our knees before him, and what we offer to him is blessing. Now, we bless God, again, by our worship and our praise and our prayers and, of course, our service to him. But that's part of the idea of blessed. Also in Psalm 129, we have this word used again relating to intercession between men. So here's the verse. It's verse number 8 of Psalm 129. It says, "Neither do they which go by say, the blessing of the Lord be upon you. We bless you in the name of the Lord." And so the psalmist here is talking about some of the failures of God's people. But what he says here indicates to us how, again, this word blessing is understood. So when you pass someone in the street, you are supposed to say as your greeting, you know, "The blessing of the Lord be upon you." You're separating from someone and they're going away and you're going your way. And so you say, "We bless you in the name of the Lord." And the idea was, of course, we think of it as saying goodbye or whatever, or hello, but it's really deeper than that. It was when you greet someone, especially someone who is your spiritual kin, brother or sister, what you want for them and desire for them is the blessing of God. And so when you would greet them, that's what you would wish upon them. When you parted, you would, you know, say, "Go with God," in essence. And we still do that today. A lot of our greetings and parting words, you know, come from that idea as well. I think about you know, in the New Testament, when Paul would introduce himself in his epistles, or sometimes at the close of them, he would say, "Grace and peace be unto you." Well, grace is charis, the Greek word that was commonly used as a greeting. So when you met someone, you would say grace to them. But it didn't just mean hello. It meant the grace of God be upon you. So when you greeted them, you were wishing for them God's blessings. Shalom is peace. That's the Hebrew greeting. And so when they met one another, they would wish the peace of God upon each other. So it was partly saying hello or goodbye, but it was more than that. It was a coming together and a parting with the blessing of God. In Spanish, you know, the word adios is a contraction of vaya con Dios, which literally means go with God. So when you say goodbye in Spanish, you're saying go with God. May God bless you on your journey. John calls that bidding someone Godspeed. And so when you part, you wish them to have a safe journey and you know, to have a good life from the blessing of God. Not just circumstances of life. I hope, you know, fate works out for you, or I hope you have good luck. The Christian, the child of God, doesn't think that way. Our desire is for their life to be good because God is blessing them. And so that's part of the idea of the word blessed. It has to do with the nature of God, who he is, and then it has to do with the intercession of men one for another, of wishing God's blessings upon each other. And then it also has to do with, and kind of what we see here, the bestowing of divine favor on someone. And that takes us back to Genesis 12, 1, 2, and 3. And we're not going to read that right now because we're going to study that passage, Lord willing, in our next lesson. But that's the promise that God made to Abraham, that those who bless thee will be blessed, he who curseth thee will be cursed. And at the end of that, he says, in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed. And so he wasn't just saying that if somebody does something good to Abraham, then something good is going to happen to them. It was deeper than that. Those who blessed Abraham, the implication is they did so in relation to the promise that God had made to him. So somebody might not know that Abraham is the chosen of God and, you know, the bloodline of the Messiah and all of that. And they might be good to Abraham and help him along his journey, and maybe God would bless them for that. But someone who did know who Abraham was and then intervened in a way to help God do good to Abraham, that's where the blessing comes from. And eventually that blessedness would be for all nations, for all people, because of what was going to happen through Abraham and his seed line, which is the coming of Jesus. And God would make that known to everyone. So there's the nature of God that results in his bestowing favor upon his creation, and especially those who are in harmony with his will and living in a way that is pleasing unto him. So that's more than just saying, this is how to be happy. It's not just how to be happy, it's how to be in favor with God and to receive the abundance of his grace. So that's one aspect of it. The second term that is translated blessed in the Old Testament, more often than others, is an interjection, almost an exclamation. You would put an exclamation point at the end of it if you were writing it out. But it means, oh, the blessedness of the man. So you think about a passage like Psalm 1, blessed is the man who walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor standeth in the way of sinners. Right? This is the person who is blessed. But it's not just you'll be happy if you do this. It's, oh, the blessedness of the man who avoids wicked people and instead puts his focus on God. Not just he's going to be happy, but the abundant blessedness of this individual. And that's really what the Beatitudes are teaching us, how to be one of those people that you can look at your life or someone else can look at your life and say, oh, the blessedness of that person. Look at what they have, what they've found in God and now, of course, in Christ, and all of the abundant, you know, things that God has bestowed upon us. But in order to have those things, we have to shape our hearts into these attitudes that we call Beatitudes. To be one of the blessed, this is the kind of heart that we have to have. And so that's the two major Old Testament terms for blessed. In the New Testament, the Greek word for blessed is an interesting word. In Greek culture, in the Greek language, it referred to those who were beyond care. Was the idea. Those who were beyond labor and even beyond death. And so the Greeks first used this word to describe their mythological gods. So while we humans are down here on earth worrying about where our next meal is going to come from, the gods are beyond that. They don't have to worry about it because they're gods, right? We worry about sickness. Well, the gods didn't have to worry about that. So they were blessed, and man was not. Eventually, as time went on, that word, they began to use it to refer to people who were extremely wealthy. So again, while the common person doesn't know where his next meal is going to come from, wealthy people don't worry about that because they have stored up or whatever. They can buy their food. And so they were beyond those kinds of care. And so that word began to be used for them. They were considered blessed. So that's the root of the idea of the Greek word. But of course, what God does, and what he does so often in both Hebrew, but especially in Greek, is to take those words that men have certain views of and definitions of, and to use them in their true meaning and in the right way. And he does that with the word blessed to show us that it's not, obviously, for mythological gods who didn't really exist. And, you know, that didn't even hold true for their mythological gods either. As the stories developed, the gods suffered and died and had all, you know, the problems of human beings in so many ways. They were just really strong in their dealing with it. But what God does is to take that word and to show that it has to do with something beyond the cares of this world. And so biblically, the word blessed, especially in the Greek word, it has to do with, and it refers to those whose sufficiency comes from God, not from the circumstances of life. So to the Greeks, if you had to struggle with where your next meal was going to come from, you were not blessed. To the Christian, if you don't know where your next meal is going to come from, you don't have to worry about it because God's going to take care of it. And Jesus literally teaches that in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 6, right? Seek ye first the kingdom of God, and all these things shall be added unto you. Don't worry about your food and clothing and those things. God's going to take care of you. And that's blessedness. It's not dependent upon the circumstances of life, but on God and our fellowship with him. So it takes that idea to a higher level. So again, I hope that we see from that it means much more than just being happy, that this is how to be happy. It has to do with a deeper idea of our fellowship and relationship with God and salvation. Now, real quickly, I'm going to mention the second question, and I'll just mention some of these verses here because we're going to study this as we go through the series. But who is blessed? In the Greek world, in the Oriental world, if you had material wealth, then you were considered blessed. In Islam, the Islamic idea of blessedness is interesting. It was a mystical idea that you could have, they call it the unveiling, the kashif is the word for it. But it was an emotional experience during which your perception would be opened and you could see things that normally were unseen. And so sometimes it would be hallucinations, you would see things or you would hear things, but the idea was that it allowed you to deny yourself and come into union with Allah, right, with God, their idea of God. And it's the duty of every Muslim to do that, by the way. And so when you have that understanding, the result of it was that you would not be afraid of death any longer. Because now you're blessed. You see the big picture. You've seen God and all of that. And so death was not something to be feared nor to be run away from. And that idea, of course, became twisted into the idea that death is not only not to be avoided, but it is to be pursued, especially in service to the religion of Islam. So if you are serving God by strapping a bomb to yourself and blowing a bunch of people up, then that's not something to be afraid of. That's a wonderful thing because you're going to be with God. And it's a twisting of what the idea was, but it's still prevalent, of course, in that world. But it comes from this idea of who is blessed. So to some, it was about material things. Other, it was this mystical experience. The world's idea is good fortune or being lucky. Sometimes even people say blessed, but they mean, you know, lucky, circumstance or whatever. Some have the idea that blessedness is a reward for good behavior, but Jesus teaches us, the Bible teaches us, who is truly blessed. And here's who they are. Number one, those whose sins are forgiven, Romans 4, 6 through 8, which is a New Testament teaching quoting an Old Testament passage. So it ties the Beatitudes together. Number two, one who is in the Lord's kingdom is blessed, Revelation 13, 14. I'm sorry, 14, 13. I always get those backwards. Number three, the person who empties himself is blessed. And that's what the Sermon on the Mount is about. Number four, the person who lives the faithful life of a Christian is blessed. Luke 16, 19, Revelation 22, 11, and 12. And then when you look at the Sermon on the Mount And those Beatitudes that begin it, it shows us that true idea of blessedness. It doesn't matter if you're rich or poor, if you're happy or sad, if you're sick or you're well, if you have abundance or if you're in need, if you're ignored by the world or you're acknowledged, if you're alone or with a multitude, if you're uplifted or you're downtrodden, if you're pressured or persecuted or even killed. In all of those states, Jesus says you can still be blessed. And that's the Bible idea of blessedness. It's much deeper than happiness, and it's certainly much deeper than how much money you have in the bank. So what we're going to do is study those blessed attitudes, the Beatitudes, starting in Genesis 12, 1, 2, and 3, and we'll come through the Old Testament to the Sermon on the Mount, and then those that follow in the New Testament. And I think it'll be a rewarding study for us and help us to, you know, keep our hearts focused and where they need to be in serving the Lord. So we'll stop here, and Lord willing, we'll look at Genesis 12 in our next lesson.